Ed Latessa, who has a PhD in criminal justice from the University of Cincinnati. And I understand that you are one of the nation's foremost experts on something. I'm not exactly sure what, but tell me.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Professor Latessa is a has a PhD in criminal justice from University of Cincinnati. Excuse me,
Ohio State,
the Ohio State
That's
University, the 2003
That's
national champions.
That's right, that would be correct. Make sure that's on the
board. Oh, yeah, but is a professor at University of Cincinnati. And is also, I would say, a nationally recognized expert on evidence-based research into what works in lowering recidivism on the web. I looked at, did a Google search with his name and saw several studies, juvenile studies in several areas. And I think he's got a presentation today on what the basis of some of his work.
All right, Dr. Latessa, do you prefer that we interrupt and ask questions, or
however you want? Doesn't bother me.
Okay.
In the least.
All right. Well, go ahead.
You ready?
You bet, sir.
Okay. Well, thank you. I should say before I begin that I am here at the request of the Department of Corrections, and I'm being funded by the National Institute of Corrections, which is a federal agency responsible for promoting best practices in corrections. They spend a lot of money on this work that I'm going to talk about. I have been out to Oregon a few times before. I've actually assessed a few programs here in the state, and it's my pleasure to come back again and talk to you. Most of my work over my career is focused on looking at correctional programs and determining whether or not they were very effective in reducing recidivism rates. In the last 10 years or so, I've started to shift that a little bit, and not only looking at specific programs, but looking at what is it about correctional programs that make them effective or not effective, as the case may be. So that work, by the way, has been going on all over the world. It is referred to as the What Works research agenda. And so I make it clear that this is really the embodiment of a lot of studies over a long period of time. I also want to say that I think that my knowledge of Oregon is that certainly the Department of Corrections has adopted and principled a lot of the work that I'm going to talk about. I think you're ahead of the curve. This is one of the states we point to as kind of at the farther end of trying to implement effective programs. So with that said, what I want to do this morning is to talk a little bit about the research to give you some basis of what that research has told us, and then to talk about kind of its implication for Oregon and programs and so forth. And I'm kind of a dinosaur. I don't do those PowerPoint things. I still use overhead, so you'll have to bear with me. And I'm certainly capable of talking for 2 hours straight, but I'm going to certainly leave time to answer questions, and feel free to interrupt me. You can ask me anything you want. I will answer any question. If I don't know the answer, I will make it up, just so you realize that. So, one of the things I want to talk just briefly about is the word evidence. We hear a lot about evidence-based practices, and that's become kind of a catchphrase today. But when we use the term evidence for this work, we're really talking about results from controlled studies. And that's important because a lot of people will, you know, view evidence as, you know, someone comes to them and says, that program really helped me, and they interpret that as evidence that the program worked. The people like myself, we're looking at controlled studies, whether it's comparison groups, experimental groups. If we don't see significant differences, then basically there's no effect. And I'm going to show you some data in a little bit on that. Second concept is risk, and I think that's an important one as well, because risk, the way we use the term, refers to the risk of reoffending, not the seriousness of the crime. So an armed robber is a more serious offender than someone who smokes marijuana. But in terms of the concept of risk, risk refers to certain characteristics they possess which give them a greater probability of coming back again. So you can be a low-risk offender that commits a fairly serious crime, or you can be a high-risk offender who commits a crime that most of us would view as very serious. That's a very important concept as well. I will tell you that the research is really based on what we call a body of knowledge. Again, you can find a study to support just about anything you want. And that's one of the problems with research. You know, you can pull a study out. You don't have any idea how well it was done. You don't have any idea the sample and whether they followed them long enough and so forth. And so I think making policy based on individual studies is risky. It's kind of like finding an expert witness. If you don't like what the expert says, you go find another one. And the way that this body of knowledge has come about has really been by looking at literally hundreds and hundreds of studies that meet certain criteria. So if a study's meet certain methodological criteria, it's included in this analysis. One of the ways we do it today is meta-analysis, and I'll show you some of those results. I'm not going to get into details about how it's done unless you have a burning interest in that. I can tell you, as a way of summary, first of all, that there is not one review of studies of the effects of just punishing offenders that have shown consistent evidence of reduced recidivism. That's not to say that people don't deserve to be punished, but what the research is indicating is that just giving people some sanction seems to have very little effect overall in subsequent recidivism rates.
Mr. Kim?
Senator.
Yeah.
Just changing the subject a little bit, but what does that say about when we increase the sentences because we see a lot of bad things happening out there, and so we ratchet up the penalties?
We call that an incapacitative kind of an approach. Take offenders off the street, keep them off the street longer. There's some research that indicates that once we get past 2 years of incarceration, the effects become somewhat negative. There's not a lot of research in that area, but there is some new studies coming out that says that's kind of the point at which the effects start to diminish from the punishment. But let me make it clear that what we would typically call punishment, locking people up, and what we typically call treatment are not mutually exclusive things. What we find is that if we don't provide interventions to reduce risk, just punishing people doesn't get us much effect. Right? And so that's what the research says. And you know, we can talk about how long do we lock people up and so forth. Clearly, if you lock people up long enough, you get a maturation effect. People grow out of crime. But that's a fairly expensive kind of policy to engage in. On the other hand, 40 to 60% of studies of correctional treatment programs show reduced recidivism rates. That's good news and that's bad news. The good news is 40 to 60% of the studies show reduced recidivism rates. The bad news is 40 to 60% of the studies don't show reduced recidivism rates. The opposite of that finding is true as well. That finding is based on studies that have been published. What usually gets published are programs that work. And so my interest early on was not in debating, you know, punishment versus treatment. The evidence was pretty clear. My interest is, what is it about those programs that are reducing recidivism that's different than the programs that aren't, the interventions that aren't effective? And so that's really what my interest was. When we look at those, this is kind of a summary of studies of correctional intervention. We call it sanctions versus treatment, based on, in this case, 30 studies and then 124 studies. We see that treatment produces a slight a reduction in recidivism of about 15%. That's about the effect size we get from the typical correctional program. Sanctions give us typically negative effects, slightly negative, not dramatic. But the first kind of piece of the What Works puzzle was breaking out programs into what we call behavioral and non-behavioral programs. And I want to point out to you that we see very dramatic differences between non-behavioral correctional programs and behavioral correctional programs. Non-behavioral programs would include things like drug education. That's a non-behavioral program. We see very small effect sizes from that kind of an intervention. On the other hand, behavioral interventions, such as cognitive behavioral, social learning models, show on average 29% effect sizes. To give you an idea what this translates into, this would mean that if 50% of a control group failed, only 20% of the treatment group would fail. And so we see, and let me also point out, this is an average effect size. So we know there are programs out there, correctional strategies, that are reducing recidivism even greater than this. The other thing we see in the research is that community-based treatment shows stronger effect sizes than institutional-based treatment. This is a kind of a meta-analysis of programs based on effective interventions. You can see that on average, community-based programming is giving us about twice the effect size as institutional programming. Now, there's a couple reasons for this. One is obviously a selection effect. That is, you're more likely to get offenders who are not amenable to treatment, psychopaths and others in an institutional setting.
Dr. Letessa, yeah. I want to state one of my biases, and you can maybe answer it as you. I've always rejected the idea of intermingling the terms treatment and corrections. Treatment infers that a person is sick in a medical sense. Now, I understand that oftentimes you have drug and alcohol issues and so on and so forth. But help me understand from your perspective when you're talking about treatment, how that fits in to that context. I mean, it just seems to me that it blurs the line between what a medical illness as opposed to a social construct.
Yeah, and you know, I agree with you. I use the term intervention, or what some states are now calling risk reduction as a more appropriate term. The state of Georgia now actually has an office of risk reduction in their Department of Corrections. I think treatment's the term that's generic, that's most often associated with things like substance abuse or mental health. But they're included in this work, and that's why I use that term. The substance abuse treatment that goes on, the mental health treatment that goes on in institutions is not separated from this work. In fact, one of the reasons I think those areas have not been very effective is because they haven't paid attention to the research very well. But I do agree, Senator. I think correctional intervention or risk reduction is a more appropriate concept for most people. I'll use that term. What this is really telling us, this data here, is that it's not that correctional programs cannot reduce recidivism. Clearly they can. This data indicates that on average about a 17% effect size. But we do not see as strong effects, particularly when there is not follow-up in the community, when offenders don't have that reentry programming that goes along. And the reasons aren't hard to figure out. Institutions are very artificial places. You know, everybody in institutions, you know, many states, they all go to work. If they're kids, they go to school. And yet, it's when they come out that they have to make those decisions and apply what they've learned. And so that's one of the reasons we think we see these differences.
Doctor?
Yes.
Thank you. I have a question in regard to that. I would think that your numbers would be skewed depending on whether you have any transitional services for offenders who are leaving the institution?
Yeah. This study, these are comparing people that get institutional treatment to people that don't get institutional treatment in a follow-up with no services outside coming back out. So what we're seeing is, yes, there's an effect from giving them treatment inside, and that's the average effect size. Community-based are those offenders that are getting services while they're out in the streets, and we see a much stronger effect size.
But don't you see also a difference if there's transitional counseling?
Yes, it's about a 15% difference.
I would think.
And that's exactly about what that would be.
Okay,
that's
great.
Right. But many inmates come out and don't get services when they come out of institutions.
And they just let them go?
Well, you know, you have states where there's no parole anymore. People just max out. They do their time. They come out. There's very little service or intervention that's required. And I dare say in many states that's probably the norm today. I think that's one of the reasons why the federal government is putting a lot of money now into reentry funding to try to help that transition, because they recognize this is the effect we get when we don't have services for those inmates.
And particularly, if I might, Mr. Chair, if you have a long-term offender who's served 15 years or more and then they're reentering society, if there's no transitional counseling from the institution and then upon reentry, I think that affects their ability to succeed as
it
well.
It does affect, but it also becomes a question of what's done in that transitional care. You know, and that's, you know, part of what this work is about. If it's simply some form of counseling, you're probably not going to get much effect.
Right.
But if it's an intervention that's designed to make sure their risk stays low, then you can see pretty good effects. And that's been part of the problem. What we've done often when they come out hasn't been very effective for a whole variety of reasons that I'll get into.
Okay, great. Thank you.
The second piece of the puzzle for the What Works research has been the work on risk factors. And this is really, I think, where many correctional programs kind of go astray. Not doing good assessment, not knowing what the major risk factors associated with recidivism are. And programs that target the wrong risk factors don't get much effect. I'm not going to go through all the research on that, but I'm going to very quickly show you what those major set of risk factors are, starting with antisocial, pro-criminal attitudes, values, beliefs, and cognitive emotional states. One of the major determinants of how we behave is how we think, how we see ourselves, how we see the world. Offenders are often characterized as having what we call criminal thinking. They don't accept responsibility for their acts. They blame others. They minimize what they do. They see themselves as the victims many times. In fact, I was in California last week. I always tell them that I go to prisons, and the reason most people are in prison is bad lawyers. That's what I hear. You know, why are you here? I had a bad lawyer. They said that they're in California. It's some dude, and they said, you know, some dude told me I could drive his car, and some dude told me that I could do this, and so we hear this a lot from offenders, and this lack of this kind of distorted thinking is highly correlated with criminal conduct. And so again, now you see why programs that are targeting this antisocial thinking are going to be more effective. Second, of course, are antisocial friends, bad friends. It's not just knowing criminals. If that were the case, correctional officers would be extremely high probability for criminal conduct. It's also isolation from anti-criminal others. This is a very important risk factor. Often we focus a lot on who they hang around with, and we don't do, a good job of replacing them with pro-social people. This is something that has been a problem, particularly in probation and parole for a long time. The third risk factor, which is one that's often ignored, are temperament and personality factors, most of which are dynamic. That is, you can target them and reduce them. But things like psychopathy, weak socialization, impulsivity, restless aggressive energy, egocentrism. It's kind of a myth that low self-esteem is highly correlated with criminal conduct. It's just the opposite. Most high-risk offenders feel pretty good about themselves. And it's important that a lot of programs target self-esteem. I'll give you the best example, or boot camps. Boot camps make offenders feel pretty good about themselves. There's only one problem. They felt pretty good when they went in. And so you're really making people more narcissistic when you put them in those kind of programs that don't reduce risk factors. Weak problem-solving skills, lack of control. A lot of offenders are very linear thinking, very concrete thinking. And so these are very important. I should point out that personality is usually working in tandem with other risk factors. Just being egocentric will not make you a high-risk offender. If that were the case, we'd have to lock up all the professors and judges in this country. But if you have antisocial personality and you have antisocial friends and you think what you do is okay, that's a real combination for a very high-risk offender. Number four on the list is history of antisocial behavior. And this is really an easy one. History is a great predictor of almost everything, right? How you behaved before is often a good predictor of how you're going to behave in the future. It's what we look at when we hire people. It's what we look at when you apply to law school or graduate school. They look at how you did. There are two problems with relying on history. One is you can't change it. It's a good predictor. But if I was first arrested at age 9, I've always been first arrested at age 9. The second problem with history, especially when we rely on it for determining risk, is you have to have it before it's a predictor. And I'll give you a good example of probably interventions that a lot of people do. Drunk drivers. You have any drunk drivers in Oregon? Mm-hmm. Got a few? Mm-hmm. Well, we have a few in Ohio. I've actually studied them for a long time, drunk drivers. It does not take a PhD to figure out that a guy with 5 DUIs has a drinking and driving problem and might do it again. That's easy. That's a no-brainer. Problem is, at one point, he only had 1 DUI. Probably had the same risk factors, except he didn't have a history yet. And what we often do is we take those first-time drunk drivers, we give them these weekend drug education programs, and we kick them out. And then when they get their second and their third and their fourth, now we realize we have a serious kind of person on our hands. And so because we don't do, often these programs don't do good assessment up front, we wait until the person has a long history before we try to intervene. And it's a lot more difficult down the road than it is early on. So those are some of the problems with history. It's a great predictor, by the way, and this is why it's a good predictor, one that everyone should be concerned about. By age 12, 40% of later serious offenders have committed their first criminal act, and by age 14, 85% have committed their first criminal act. There was a recent national study done, and it looked at what they call a cohort study. I looked at adult male rapists, men who had committed rape over the age of 21. The percentage that had not committed a serious crime as a juvenile was zero. So when you get an adult male rapist, you're guaranteed you have someone who started that behavior at a young age. Number five on the list are family factors, including family criminality, variety of psychological problems in the family, including lack of care, cohesiveness, poor parental supervision, outright neglect, and abuse. This is obviously a strong predictor for, it's a predictor for both, but it's more dynamic for kids than it is for adults. Adults, that is, if I was abused as a child, it's not much you can do when I'm 40 years old. That is, it's a good predictor, but it's happened pretty, it's a historical fact. With kids, it's much more dynamic and amenable to intervention. And finally, low levels of education, vocational or financial achievement. These six areas are what we call major risk factors. And they really are the areas that correctional programs need to address if they're going to have a substantial effect on recidivism rates.
Dr. Letessa,
yes.
Again, I've spent many years dealing with criminals, putting them in prison, and registering them as sex offenders, and sometimes having some very frank conversations with them.
Yeah.
Almost every criminal I've ever spoken to, convicted or not convicted.
What's that?
I'm just saying, people that I've talked to, who I know are criminals, you know, maybe haven't gone to court yet, but they're admitting to me certain behavior. They all have these factors.
Yeah.
I mean, from 1 through 6.
Varying degrees.
Yeah. The only place I'm seeing a variation of this is in adult sex offenders.
Yeah, many of them work.
Because that's a whole new typology that seems to be very different than early assumptions.
Yeah, if you look at sex offenders, this is a good example. Many of them profile out differently. They have jobs, they're educated, they can come from all walks of life.
Right.
They have extremely distorted thinking. And they'll say things like, well, she was asking for it, she came on to me.
Right.
She's 8 years old. Right? I mean, you know, this very, very, very antisocial kind of thinking that goes on. Some offenders, of course, are unemployed. They don't work. I'll put this. I had someone yet last week. I was in Wisconsin, and somebody from corrections said, "Well, you know, 40% of our offenders don't have jobs." And I said, "I think you have to ask yourself the question: is why don't 40% have jobs?" I mean, there was a time recently in this country where anybody that wanted a job could have one. And we still saw a high unemployment rate among this group. A lot of it's cognitive. And I always ask people the question, if you had to support your family, would you take just about any job? Most people would. I mean, we'd pump gas, we'd work at Kmart. I mean, most of us would do whatever we had to do to support their families. Offenders say things like, I'm not working for $8 an hour. You know what that guy wanted me to do at work? And they don't understand why you can't come late and with booze on your breath and so forth. I mean, a lot of it is cognitive. Now, I'm not saying these people all have the education and the skills. They need those as well. But oftentimes what we fail to do in correctional programs is we teach the guy which end of the shovel to use, without really dealing with the cognitive, the lack of values about work and why it's important. And so I don't disagree with you that many of them have them. But in fact, when we assess offenders, what we see is a fairly normal curve. That is, we have some very high-risk people that have all of these factors and then some. And then we have other offenders that are low-risk.
Well, I guess I'm just kind of curious because, you know, Oregon, in the late 80s, we instituted some multidisciplinary models for child sexual abuse intervention, and we've become very good at arresting and prosecuting offenders. And from my experience, we're now focusing on individuals that prior to probably the mid-80s, we didn't have a large focus on it. An example, 11,000 inmates in the Oregon State Penitentiary System, 3,500 of them are sex offenders. Mm-hmm. Many of them are not these kind of personnel. I mean, they're higher functioning individuals who did have jobs. Who, for instance, we have a microneurologist or neurosurgeon. You know, for sex abuse, he's going to go to prison. We've got people like that who are a very different group of individuals now going to prison. Does that seem to skewer all this stuff?
No,
you have two different groups of individuals.
You have some that do profile out, but another group that profiles out different would be habitual drunk driving. I mean, these guys don't see themselves as criminals. They go to work, they support their families, they don't, you know, they'll even say, or another one is domestic violence offender. I mean, these guys will say, hey, I go to work every day, I support my family, I'm not a criminal. Yet the same guy thinks that, you know, that he's really the victim. I mean, she knows better than to do those things. She's supposed to have my dinner ready. I mean, you know, you hear it often. So much of it is cognitive for many of them. But it's not the only risk factor. I mean, but cognitive distortions would fit the profile for sex offenders, for domestic violence offenders, and for many of the people that get involved in crime, who basically say, have a set of neutralizations which basically say it's okay to do these things. And let me say this about the sex offender research, because that research indicates we can reduce recidivism rates for sex offenders. But again, there are sex offenders for whom there are no interventions, just as there are other types of offenders from whom we have really the high-risk psychopathic offender. There are no known interventions to reduce their recidivism. Research indicates when we put them in programs, we make them worse because they get better skill at manipulating people and using people. So there your strategy is different. Your strategy is identify them, control them, don't put them into these programs because you disrupt the programs as well. Mm-hmm. All of this work has led to some principles. It's really the principles that I want to kind of focus on and talk about, because they're really what the research has told us and really ought to be the kind of basis of programs. And the first is the risk principle. Treatment intervention should be used with the higher risk offenders. Here's a way to think of it. If half of the men and women that come out of Oregon's prisons don't come back, why would we worry about that half? It's the half that come back that pose the most risk to the public. Right? They're the ones that are recidivists. Of the half that comes back, there's a percentage of whom we have no known interventions. Let's say that's 10%. That's a group that we identify, we put on very strict kind of monitoring, and if they screw up, we lock them up again. But for the remainder of those offenders, That rest of that percentage that are likely to come back to prison, they're the ones that you want to focus on with your programs and your interventions. And I think this has a lot of implications for just about every state, especially with dollars being the way they are.
Mr. Chair, Doctor, I have a confusion going on in my mind about that last comment, because my notes indicate that you just told me there was no known intervention for a high risk.
No, I said the highest risk.
The highest risk. Right. So the highest is different than the high risk.
Than the higher, right.
Okay.
They would be different. For that highest group, for that slim kind of top of the food chain, we really have no known intervention.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So this is below that.
Right. And if you think about it, the half that come back, that are going to come back, it's a percentage of them that we really have no known interventions. It's that other 40% that we really want to focus our programs on.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you. What kind of diagnostic tools do you have to determine what that highest risk that you just basically give up on?
Well, there's a number of tools. I know that Oregon has kind of developed their own. I'll just show you a couple. This is one that's out there called the North Point Risk Assessment. North Point, the way North Point set up this instrument, you can see here it gives you four overall risk potentials: violence, recidivism, failure to appear, and community noncompliance. And within this instrument, it has areas like socialization failure, which would be a measure of psychopathy. So someone that scores very high on that indicator would be someone who's probably not going to be real amenable to treatment. The standard instrument is called the Hare Psychopathy Index, the PCL, Psychopathy Checklist. That instrument is the most widely used instrument with psychopaths. And anyone that scored over a certain score would be considered a high-risk psychopathic offender, not amenable to most interventions. So those are two examples. The Hare instrument as I said, is kind of considered the standard for that measure. These are the indicators of hair. So you'll recognize probably when you were dating, you dated a few of these guys. But, you know, glib, superficial, grandiose sense of self, stimulation seeking, pathologically lying, lack of remorse, shallow effect. So if you scored real high on this instrument, you would be considered a psychopath. So these are two instruments that would be used. This one, North Point, is actually, in my opinion, a better instrument to measure overall risk. It gives you better indicators. And then the LSI is the other kind of major instrument, the level of service inventory. So those are the three of the more common assessment protocols for that.
Mr. Chairman, follow up, do you find that most places around the country use this kind of assessment and basically don't attempt interventions with people who are identified like this?
It varies by what states do. With Washington State, for example, they use the level of service inventory, so everyone is screened with that instrument. In Wisconsin, they screen their sex offenders are all screened for psychopathy. They put their high risk psychopathic sex offenders all together in one unit in a prison. So they keep them away from their other offenders. So it varies by state and how they do it. In some cases, they'll only screen for psychopathy if they think there's a reason to do it, and then they'll come in and screen for it. Others will screen everybody, kind of a blanket assessment. So it varies from state to state. Every state Department of Corrections does some classification and assessment, but the quality and the degree varies significantly. This state screens for a lot of criminogenic risk factors in their assessment. Some of the counties in this state, I know, use the LSI. Others, you know, don't. But, you know, you kind of leave it up to them to decide. So it does vary jurisdiction to jurisdiction. I want to talk a little bit about the risk principle, and I want to show you results from a study that was just done. And I think this study has a lot of implications for, as I said, for every state. This is the largest study of community-based correctional treatment facilities that was ever done in the country. We had 13,000 offenders. This study just came out this summer. And I want to show you this because this study is going to change who Ohio puts in its programs based on this research. And the other thing I think is important about this research is we included offenders who were coming out of prison as well as offenders who did not go to prison. And that's of course, everybody. Mm-hmm. With 37 halfway houses and 15 community-based correctional treatment facilities, we call them CBCFs in Ohio, we have 19 of these facilities. They are locally managed programs for felons. They are funded by the state, run by the local communities. We're a Community Corrections Act state, like Oregon is. And so these are dollars that go back into the communities. We did a 2-year follow-up on all offenders. Our recidivism measured new arrests and incarceration in a state penal institution. I'm going to focus on incarceration as the outcome measure. Our experimental group had 3,700 offenders released from prison in fiscal year 99 and placed in one of 37 halfway houses in Ohio. These were all men and women coming out of prison into one of these transitional programs. We had 3,600 offenders directly sentenced to one of the 15 community-based facilities. These were not men and women that went to prison. These were felons who were court-ordered into a 6-month secure facility. These are secure facilities. Our comparison group were 5,800 offenders released from prison onto parole supervision during the same time period. These were men and women who did not go to a program. They came out of prison on parole. They got some service on parole. But they were not put into one of these higher-end programs. And this is what's really important for looking at the risk principle. The problem with most programs is low-risk offenders always do better than high-risk offenders. That's why they're low-risk. Right? Because they have these characteristics that make them low-risk. So we automatically think low-risk offender programs are doing better with low-risk offenders. Well, in this study, everybody was given a risk score based on 14 items that predicted outcome. We compared low-risk offenders who were placed in a program to low-risk offenders that were not placed in a program. We compared high-risk offenders who were placed in a program with high-risk offenders that were not placed in the program. I want to show you what we found. Ohio, like many states, is faced with a big budget crisis. And the impetus for this study was to look at these programs because the state wanted to find out which programs weren't working and which programs were. And so that was the initial reason they did this study. I want to show you what we found. First, when we looked at low-risk offenders. At the bottom of the screen is all of the programs in Ohio. You have the same kind of programs in the state of Oregon. You have residential programs throughout the state. You have halfway houses. I know some of the counties run facilities. What you're seeing here in the red, the negative numbers are how much worse low-risk offenders who went into the programs did than low-risk offenders who did not go into programs. The black are the programs that reduced recidivism rates for low-risk offenders. The first thing you can see is that most of the programs increased failure rates for low-risk offenders. And when you do controlled studies, you expect at best no difference. When you see negative numbers, this means that low-risk offenders who went into this program had a 36% higher recidivism rate than low-risk offenders who did not go into the program. By the way, that's a halfway house. So those were all people coming out of prison. You can see here the best they could do was a 9% reduction. Next, we looked at what we called low-moderate risk offenders. These were offenders that scored a little higher on the risk instrument. I can show you those breakouts if you want. Now you see it's about half and half. But here again, the best they could do was 11% reduction in recidivism for low-moderate risk offenders. Again, increasing the recidivism. Then we looked at moderate risk offenders. What we see is that most of the programs, not all of them, but most of them, had some effect on moderate risk offenders. The best was 19%, a 19% reduction in recidivism. Some program, by the way, 9 programs didn't work with anybody. They increased recidivism at every risk level. And finally, this is the effect on high-risk offenders. Now you see, not only did most of the programs reduce recidivism, but you can see here some of them over 30%. And to put that in perspective, there were 13,000 offenders in this study. If every program in Ohio could reduce recidivism by 30%, and all the offenders put in were high risk, 30% of 13,000 is about 4,000 offenders in that sample. That we're talking about. Where you really see the risk principle is here. Let me show you the risk principle. Let's take these programs, this program here, Mahoning County. This program reduced recidivism for high-risk offenders by 32%. The same program increased recidivism for low-risk offenders by 29%.
So, Doctor, what do you call that effect?
That is the risk principle.
Well, I'd call it the chipmunk effect. It's simply because you've got people who are basically spinning their wheels. They're stuck in a system and they can't get out.
Well, we're making them worse.
I mean, exactly what you're saying is if you'd left them to their own devices, being low-risk individuals, they probably would have survived.
They would have. They're pro-social people. They wouldn't be low-risk.
They would have made positive choices on their own. You put them in a program, they're stuck in a program they can't get out. There seems to be a lack of hope.
Plus with high-risk people.
Right. I mean, it's the same thing we were doing to people in the penitentiary system in Oregon 10 years ago or more when you sentence them to 20 years in prison. They're out 42 days, and they're on parole in perpetuity, and they're back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. They never saw, to any degree, a hope that they'd ever get out of the system. That's my explanation.
Yeah. And the problem is, you know, as we said in Ohio, it's one thing not to get any effect. It's another thing to spend $60 a day to increase recidivism rates. And that's what's happening. Now, the good news for Ohio is that only 5% were low risk, but 22% were low moderate risk. So almost a third of the offenders that were in our study, and these were the men and women coming out of prison, half of them were the men and women coming out of prison, remember, would fall into this category. And so for Ohio, this means we're not going to put these people into these programs anymore.
Did you find a difference between men and women?
We did not. We did find, I'll show you data in a minute, we did find that co-ed programs did worse than single-sex programs. We did find that. But in terms of outcome, no. Same exact principles held true for the men and the women.
Thank you. On your charts there where you have the different risk levels and how they did, the print's too small for me to see the bottom of what programs you're talking about. Are the programs the same across the...
No. They're all... Yeah, it doesn't matter what their names are. That's just the names of the programs. You wouldn't know who they were.
But it's not the same from chart to chart.
Yes. No, well, the names of them are the same, but no, the programs can move around depending on how they did. Right?
I see. So you always have the worst, so you line them up according to...
We've moved, and it's based on the effect, not on the program. So, for example, we'll go back here, let's see,
So that really bad one on the left is not always the same program.
Not always the same one. Actually, that happens to be, they flip-flop a little bit. We had 9 programs, as I said, that didn't work with anybody.
What stands out as one of the worst programs?
Oh, two of the worst would be... where's the high risk? Two of the worst... Well, I have those programs over all this. These two programs are the worst. This is the overall treatment effect. River City, which is a 200-bed co-ed facility in Cincinnati. It's a community-based correctional facility. And Fresh Start, which is a halfway house in Cleveland. Those are the worst two programs in the state.
Were you able to determine why they were so bad?
Yeah.
Why?
I'm going to show you that now.
Okay.
That is a sharp group. I'm telling you, you're hitting me down here. The second principle is called the need principle, and the need principle says basically target the known criminogenic predictors of crime and recidivism. These are what we call criminogenic needs. We call them that because they are highly correlated with criminal conduct. Things like antisocial attitudes, substance abuse, peer associations, antisocial feelings, deviant sexual behavior. Those are correlated with criminal behavior. Non-criminogenic, anxiety, low self-esteem, medical needs, creative abilities, physical conditioning. Those kind of things have very little to do with why people are criminal. And here's a meta-analysis result that I think is very important, because if you read it closely, what it's saying is that programs that target at least 4 to 6 more criminogenic needs reduce recidivism about 31%. Programs that target 1 to 3 more non-criminogenic needs have basically no effect. Let me tell you a little bit about the Ohio program. We visited every program. We cataloged everything they did with offenders. Every program in Ohio targeted substance abuse. Huh? Substance abuse is a criminogenic risk factor. Every program in Ohio targeted employment. Every program in Ohio targeted education. But then we had programs that, in addition to those areas, they had Tai Chi, they had yoga, they had current events, they had women's issues, they had art therapy. In other words, when you start weighing what those programs were doing, this doesn't say 50-50. This says 4 to 6 more criminogenic risk factors. And so what we found in Ohio, and I'll show you in a minute with their data, is the same thing from this study. That is, programs that kind of lose sight of the target don't have much effect. And I'd love to tell you that that's the exception, but it's not. Many correctional programs do things that, quite frankly, aren't going to have much effect on recidivism. Because what happens is they don't do good assessment, or they let the staff kind of decide what they ought to be focusing on, and before you know it, the program starts to drift. And that gets us to kind of our third principle, and I want to show you the data from Ohio that you asked about. The third principle basically says treatment should be behavioral in nature. Because the research indicates those are the most effective type of correctional programs we have out there. Behavioral programs include cognitive behavioral, structured social learning programs, programs in which offenders are taught new skills, practice, reinforce those behaviors. I want to show you this. The question came up that you asked. Because I had to go around the state and show all these programs their data. I'm not that popular with some of them, as you can imagine. But then the question became, why are some programs showing these negative effects? And so we started to look a little closer at the data. And it really fits the principles that I've talked about. The first thing we looked at was the program cognitive behavioral or something else? Something else could have been therapeutic community, faith-based, 12-step, disease model, eclectic versus COG. Programs that were COG had an 8% change in recidivism. Programs that were everything else had a 0 effect. Then we looked at the relationship between criminogenic programming and effect. Programs that targeted more than 25%, that was all we used as a standard here, 5% change in recidivism. Programs that targeted less than 25%, 16% increase in recidivism.
Say that again for me. I'm not sure that I follow what you just said.
In other words, these are programs that, as I said before, they might have had 3 criminogenic risk factors they targeted, but then they had 7 or 8 or 9 that were non-criminogenic.
All right.
They did self-esteem groups. They did groups on, how do you feel? They did, some art therapy. They did, as I said, yoga, Tai Chi, you name, the list goes on. It's a really incredible list. The karaoke singing, that's always my favorite as well.
Now
what you're seeing here is, this is the percentage change in recidivism. So programs that had at least 25% reduced recidivism by 5% on average. Programs that had less than 25% increased recidivism by 16%. That's a 21% swing in programs.
And that's consistent with your earlier statement.
This is from all the research, and this is the actual Ohio data. So, because I was asked the same question by the program, why aren't some of us working? And I said, well, where do you fall in this?
Right? Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator.
This self-esteem is really kind of surprising because it was seen as a panacea for so long.
Yeah.
Did you derive any indication that... techniques to basically reduce self-esteem would work, or was self-esteem just not a factor? In other words, do they have too much self-esteem?
Yeah, most higher-risk offenders are pretty egocentric. They have too much self-esteem. They're self-centered, is what it is.
And does the cognitive technique break that down?
Yes. You would want to break that down. Now, that's not true with every type of offender. There's two types of offenders, two categories of offenders for whom low self-esteem appears to be correlated with criminal conduct. That would be child molesters and domestic violence offenders. For those two groups, low self-esteem appears to be correlated with risk. But for most other offenders, the correlation is very, very low. It's the opposite. It's the high self-esteem. You want those people to be less self-centered, right? To think more about others and what their actions do to others and harm done to the victim and so forth. They often lack empathy and because all they care about is themselves. I mean, if you listen to most offenders and interview them, it's all about them. It's rarely about anyone else. The problem is if you target self-esteem, you try to increase people's self-esteem without reducing their antisocial thinking, you get someone that's even, they feel better about being bad, basically. And the problem, I think, what is a lot of offenders will say things like, I'm not very good at that. I can't do what you do. And we interpret that as low self-esteem. What it really is an antisocial attitude. I don't understand why anybody would want to work 9 to 5. You know? So I'm not good at school. What they're really saying is I don't like school. You know? I think what happens is that gets interpreted as low self-esteem when really it's part of this set of kind of attitudes and attributes that offenders have that basically say, well, because I'm not good at it, it's okay for me to do these other things. We looked at the relationship between treatment and supervision intensity and treatment effect. That is, the programs that had some variation with higher risk offenders received more services, 7% change in recidivism, programs where there was basically everybody got the same thing. We call that one size fits all. A lot of programs fall into that category. Then we looked at the relationship between what we call role playing and treatment effect. This is important because what it was telling us was programs where in almost every session the offender had to practice some new skill versus programs where it happened only occasionally, we see that effect. We also looked at, and I think this is an important one as you think about evaluating your program. Other researchers have found this as well. Basically, there was a relationship between how long the program had been in operation and the treatment effect. What this is really telling us, your newer programs probably shouldn't undergo an outcome study when they're brand new. Other researchers found it usually takes about 2 to 3 years for a program to get its sea legs. And so by subjecting them to research, you're probably going to get that. And then we also found, as I said before, mixed facilities did not... We did find that mixed facilities did a little better than all female, but single sex did better than co-ed.
But isn't all female single sex?
Yeah, it is. That was also a finding here. It was not. This was also
in this day and age, it's questionable.
Yeah. We found it. The female program did not do quite as well, and we also found that single sex did better than co-ed. So, and it's probably in there. I didn't pull it out. But here's what happens when we put it all together. The average effect for all the programs in Ohio was only a 4% reduction in recidivism. We took all 50 programs together, we found that 4%, that's not a whole lot for the kind of money that we're spending on these programs. But we found that we had the lowest was a 41% increase in recidivism, and the highest was a 43% increase or reduction in recidivism. Well, here's what happens when we start putting those things together that I just showed you. If the program had a termination rate in an acceptable range, they reduced recidivism about 5%. If they were at least 3 years old, they got to 10%. If they were cognitive behavioral, they got to 18%. If they had targeted criminal, at least 25% criminogenic risk factors, if they reported lots of role playing, and if they varied intensity by risk, when you start putting together these characteristics, you see a 39% reduction in recidivism.
Could you read those again?
This is a termination rate in an acceptable range. That means that the program, not everybody completed it, but they didn't also throw every other person out. It was about programs that had about a 3 out of 4 completion rate were the most effective.
Doctor, were these government-run programs?
These were a combination. I'd say all the CBCFs, of the 15, I'd say 10 are government, 5 are contract. But the halfway houses probably all are contract. That did not make a difference. We looked at that. Here's what I think is important other also for you, not just the findings from the Ohio study, but from a research perspective. What this told us was there's a hell of a range in programming here. And by having what Ohio's going to do now is we're going to replicate this study every few years because Ohio's not interested in funding programs that are giving them negative effects, increasing recidivism rates. And so some of these programs, there's a task force now that's been created in the state. They have representatives from the programs, from the Department of Corrections, from the judiciary, and they're going to come up with, they have to come up with a plan for how they're going to improve these programs. We also learned, as researchers, we learned that if we didn't break these programs out, program by program, we just saw a 4% reduction in recidivism. You know what happens? The bad programs cancel out the good programs. Okay. But by breaking them out, we're able to see those programs that are reducing recidivism 20 and 30%. That's no mean feat when you're talking about higher risk offenders. And so we learned a lot from the research. The other thing we did find, I should tell you this because we looked at parole violators separately. And what we found was that they had a treatment effect for parole violators regardless of their risk level. Whether they were low risk or high risk, putting a parole violator in a community program reduced their recidivism. About 12%, I think, on average. Yeah, 12% on average. And so now the department's strategy is if you're a parole violator, okay, instead of just automatically shipping you back to an institution, they're going to put you in one of these programs as an intermediate step because we did find that regardless of risk, that seemed to be a stabilizing effect for these individuals.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Professor, when you say, I'm trying to get a handle on what these are secure. I'm trying to figure out if we have anything like that would look like this in Oregon, a secure halfway house where you could put a probation violator. I mean,
yeah, the halfway houses are not secure.
Okay.
The community-based correctional facilities are secure.
Okay.
All right. The halfway houses are typical, you know, staff secure. People can leave. There's nothing they do about it.
Okay.
The CBCFs have, by law, offenders are not allowed to leave for the first 30 days. After that, many of them, they're transported to work and other kind of things in the community. But when they're in those facilities, they are locked down. The doors are locked. So this is really kind of every kind of program you could have.
I'm going to state another one of my biases and have you argue me out of... How do these programs differ from the late 60s, early 70s halfway house programs, at least in my opinion.
The bad ones don't?
Well, they tended to be failed programs. I mean, basically, you're arresting these people who are out shoplifting, and they're living in a halfway house.
Well, these people aren't. These are people coming out of prison,
right. The ones
that went to these halfway houses.
Right. I'm talking about people that have been out of prison, but we were arresting them anyway, and they'd go back to the halfway house, and you'd arrest them again 2 weeks later.
Yeah. Well, some of these halfway houses are mom and pop, three hots and a cot and some counseling, you know, get them a job kind of mentality, not very effective. Other programs in this study are extremely structured programs. Offenders come in, very good assessment, very good criminogenic COG program, structured curriculums, moving offenders through. So we have the whole range.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody has the whole range. You know, I mean, I go to states and assess programs all the time. I can show you great programs. I can show you programs I wouldn't send anybody to. The difference is each one's getting about $60 a day.
Right. Well, is the effort then to weed out the ones that aren't effective and not pay them?
Well, I don't want to speak for the state, but I think that the ones that aren't effective are going to have to demonstrate that they're going to change how they do business. I know that they brought the nine in for a meeting to talk about what they're going to do to improve their programming. Here's what we learned. You know, recidivism rates across programs, there's two reasons you have variation. One is due to the offenders, right? And if I give you all, Boy Scouts, you'll have lower recidivism rates than if I give you all psychopaths. But our risk measure allowed us to control for that. We gave everybody a risk score based on their risk factor. That leaves one other possibility for why programs have such great variation. Some programs are well run and well designed, and some programs aren't. You know, and that's where most of my work has been, is really looking at programs. And just in the little short time I have, you know, to be honest, many correctional programs are based on custom, tradition, and imitation, and not on scientific evidence. This is an example. I just got this, cut this out of the paper. I love this one. Gardening Conquers All, How to Cut Your Jail Recidivism Rate by 50% by having them go to a garden. Now, this is we can excuse this because it come out of San Francisco, but this is often what we see in programs that are, you know, that are kind of poorly designed and poorly conceived. Let me find out my list here. Some of the programs that we've looked at are not, you know, are not likely to be effective. These are the most effective models we see in the research. Structured social learning programs. These are more associated with your residential programming, your institutional programming, where you can structure an environment to basically model and teach people new skills. Cognitive behavioral programs are very popular today because they're very transportable. You can do them in the community, you can do them in schools, you can do them in probation departments. There are a lot of cognitive curriculums coming out now. Cognitive curriculums that are structured programs that attempt to break down this distorted thinking that offenders have and teach them new ways to behave. Cognitive programming now has been designed for substance abusers, for anger, for violence, for other kind of behaviors. The problem is that just because you have a cognitive program doesn't mean that it's being well done. And that's a different issue, but an important one. And finally, family-based interventions. These are particularly used with juveniles. that train them on appropriate behavioral techniques. These are the most effective. Then we've got some things that don't work very well. And I call these dead horses. I got this from my friends in Oklahoma. It says, Lakota tribal wisdom says, when you're riding a dead horse, the best strategy is to dismount. However, in corrections, we try other strategies, including the following. Buy a stronger whip. Change riders. Say things like, this is the way we've always ridden this horse. Point a committee to study the horse. Range to visit other sites to see how they ride dead horses. Create a training session to increase our riding ability. Harness several dead horses together for increased speed. Declare the horse no horse is too dead to beat. Provide additional funding to increase the horse's performance. Declare the horse is better, faster, and cheaper dead. Study alternative uses for dead horses and promote the dead horse to a supervisory position.
That would be in the police department.
Here are some things that don't work. Again, when I say don't work, there's not a lot of empirical evidence. They reduce recidivism. Risk management strategies that do not include interventions designed to focus on risk reduction. They're pretty good at managing offenders, but in terms of reducing recidivism rates, unless there's some type of intervention, and these would be things like scared straight, shaming programs, intensive supervision, shock probation, electronic monitoring, boot camps. Research has not been very kind to these interventions. In some cases, we get no effect. In other cases, we see increases. Juvenile boot camps show pretty significant increases in recidivism.
Thank you. Thank you. Doctor, I had to laugh about the first one, scared straight.
Yeah.
Because I went to high school in the early 70s, mm-hmm. and we had people come in about these programs. They showed us the movie Splendor in the Grass and talked about all these programs to try to keep us from violating social mores. It didn't work, but...
No, they don't work.
And it's nice to see that validated here.
Yeah, the research, there's a new study out on scared straight programs all over the country, and none of them most have shown increases. The big one in New Jersey, the famous one, you know, Peter Falk, Colombo, that increased recidivism by 30% for the kids that went through it. And I had someone in Rahway tell me, well, that program was never designed to reduce recidivism. It was designed to make the lifers feel better about themselves. So I said, let me get this straight. You were willing to increase recidivism by 30% to get some lifers to feel good. What happens is most of the kids that run through those programs don't get scared by them. That actually reinforces their kind of risk-taking and their antisocial. It's a badge of honor for many of them. So the studies have not been kind. But neither has the research been good to what we call talking cures. Drug prevention focused on fear and other emotional appeals. That includes DARE programs. I know they're popular, but of the 6 or 7 national studies, none have shown the kids go through them or any less.
Makes cops feel better.
What's that?
Makes cops feel
it
better.
It does. Well, it does. It doesn't do harm, so that's good. I'm like the wrong way. Drug education, client-centered approaches. You know, that's programs where they ask the offenders what they want to focus on, what do they think their problems are. Not very...
Dr. Letessa, let me ask you a question. For some reason, this brings me back to my days of studying criminology at Portland State University. I have one of my books it's called Radical Non-Intervention.
Yeah, it doesn't work. Yeah.
I've got so many of these things where professors have written books because they have to publish something or they're...
I can tell you something, Senator. Sean, you know what? I'm glad you mentioned that because I actually have more extensive... list of let me find that one. Of what doesn't work. And when I say that to people, they all look at me. I tell them there was a book written in the 70s. There it is, right there. Radical Non-Intervention.
Yeah.
And
it books
doesn't work. It's written by a guy named Schur out of California, so that explains something. But the fact of the matter is, it doesn't, it's not effective. Also, what we call vague, unstructured rehabilitation programs. Counseling for everyone. And they get to be very leery of those kind of programs, you know, where they say, well, we're going to do counseling. Well, that means different things to different people. Good programs are structured. They go in with a curriculum. They know what they're going to target. And they skill build. They make sure the offender has acquired pro-social attitudes and behavior. Life skills, case management, good relationship with the offender is a primary goal. These are not very effective approaches. A lot of what we did in the 70s were these feel-good kind of programs. Leave them alone, they'll grow out of it. Or you know, sit them in a circle and sing Kumbaya. Doesn't work. And also, as I said before, targeting non-crime-producing needs are not very effective. I want to kind of end. I want to show you this is kind of the effects of program integrity on recidivism. What it's showing you, this is a meta-analysis that was done a few years ago, the percentage change in recidivism based on these characteristics. So programs that had a specific model had a 22% change in recidivism. Programs that didn't had a 5% change in recidivism. Programs where there were trained workers, 23% versus 7%. Supervised workers, heaven forbid we should supervise, 33% versus 7%. Printed manuals, monitor change, adequate dosage, and involved researcher. Having somebody studying the program, because programs that have a researcher usually have data coming back telling them how well they're working and so forth. And I just want to kind of give you some observations at the end. One is that the research is not a fad. It's really not going away. Whether states or programs decide they're going to look at the research is really irrelevant to people that do it. This is based on an incredibly large body of knowledge. And, you know, I get some folks who say, well, you know, again, going back to the dead horse, that's not how we do things. But it's not going to change the research. What works is not a program or an intervention. It's a set of principles based on research. And it's really, I think, important that they be incorporated into what you do. Saying programs are cognitive behavioral doesn't make it so. I go to a lot of typical program I go to today. On Monday, they'll do drug education. On Tuesday, they'll have a cognitive group, a good criminal thinking cognitive group. On Wednesday, they'll do art therapy. On Thursday, they'll do karaoke singing, and they'll say to me, we're a cognitive program. And I'll say, no, you're an eclectic program that has a cog group on Tuesday night. Having a model is extremely important. Some states have gone as far as to insist in contracts that providers follow certain approaches. They kind of gotten away from this notion of just trusting them to know what they're doing. And finally, of course, you need to, at least for the corrections folks, they need to develop strategies for bringing other providers, particularly substance abuse and mental health, into the what works fold. I've not talked about substance abuse, but we know that criminality is an independent factor that affects outcome for substance abusers. About half of substance abusing offenders began their criminal conduct before their substance abuse. 25% simultaneously, and 25% their substance abuse, then their criminal conduct. So for some people, drugs leads to their criminal behavior. But for half, that's not true. And so substance abuse programs that do not target the criminal conduct don't get very far. And that's a problem, because we bring in a lot of substance abuse treatment, we spend a lot of money on it with offenders, and we don't see much effect. And the other problem is they follow a model, a 12-step disease model, that's not shown to work with these people very well. Mm-hmm. They've got to use a more cognitive approach.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
Yes.
Do you see any logistical problems with having all cognitive all the time? I mean, is there a burnout factor?
It shouldn't be. It's not necessarily all cognitive all the time, but you have to start by targeting that cognitive aspect of behavior. A good example. You've never had a job. You think working is for chumps, and you have no skills. Now, I don't want to start by teaching you a skill. I want to start by targeting your thinking. Once I've done that, once I've got you ready to go, I now have to give you some skills. You still have to know which end of the shovel to use. So it's not all cognitive. Okay. And that's why we always talk about, and I think there's a problem with just saying cognitive, because for a lot of people, cognitive is just restructuring the thinking. Good cognitive programs do as much skill building as they do restructuring.
So what you're saying is if you've had just life skills, that's not enough. If you combine them with cognitive, but would it be at all productive to compile a list, and maybe you have, of programs like self-esteem building, art therapy, whatever, that you just clearly know don't work in any context, and compile that, and would that be useful, and have you done it?
Well, it's been done. Here again lies the dilemma in that. When we look at a program, a correctional program, our standard is that 80% of what they target is criminogenic. That means 20% can be non-criminogenic. I like to tell people when they build programs to think of programming and activities as two different things. There's nothing wrong with letting somebody do yoga, but recognize that's not a criminogenic factor. So if I tell people, if I'm designing a program, I'm going to make my participants acquire certain behaviors and skills, and as a reward for that, maybe they can choose some activities to participate in. Some of them want to do art. Some of them want to do more recreation. Some of them want to do, you know, other things. I don't have a problem with that, provided that they have done the things that are related to their behavior. So that's kind of the downside of that. And people hear, well, we can't ever do that kind of stuff.
Those would be your electives.
What's that?
Those would be your electives.
Those would be your electives.
Let me ask you a question. I asked earlier about differences with respect to male, female. Do you find any differences with racial issues with individuals of one race or the other in terms of their response to any of these particular...
We often find differences in how people do in programming based on a range of what we call personal characteristics. One would be cognitive functioning. Right? I mean, I can't put somebody who's low functioning in a program that requires a high level of normal functioning. Ethnic and cultural, gender, race differences can also be what we call responsivity factors. That is, if I wouldn't put somebody that only spoke, you know, that where English was a second language in a program, you know, that was all English. They wouldn't understand it. Those ethnicity and race are not risk factors. You know, being black or brown doesn't make it increase your likelihood of being a criminal. But oftentimes programs are not delivered in a way that recognize those cultural racial differences in people. That's what happens with some programs. For example, putting men and women together in groups. The men often dominate those groups. You know, putting women that have been abused into a group that's very confrontational is not a good strategy. You know, and so race factors into that, but in most studies, if the program delivered well, race disappears. It doesn't make much difference.
And, you know, one of the reasons I ask, again, is my experience. When I worked in Southeast Portland, which we called Felony Flats, largely white population. In my opinion, and the opinion of people that I work with, it's probably more dangerous as a police officer to work in that community than it was to work in the homogeneous black community, the albino community, although perceptions were different. I think the general public perception was one thing, but in actuality, it was very different. What I observed was that many of the lower functioning white people they felt superior, even though they were idiots for the most part. Mm-hmm. They felt superior to everyone else, and they were more likely to shoot a police officer, mm-hmm. and seemed to lack any kind of cultural training in their own environment. Whereas in the black community, there tended to be religious beliefs, there tended to be a societal kind of an underpinning that existed, where that seemed to be absent in many of the Felling Flats people.
And those are what? Antisocial attitudes, values, and beliefs. I mean, what you have is a group of people who basically, you know, have these entrenched kind of views that they're, even though they don't have these skills, that they feel like they're better than other people.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, and that's one of the reasons I think we see in some black communities some success with working with black churches and other groups, because they have that cohesiveness and they're able to reach out. But it's cognitive. I mean, that's really what you're seeing.
Right. It was an observation of mine. It was if what the public believed because of public perception or television or whatever it was really diametrically opposed. As a police officer, if you were going to get shot, you're going to get assaulted, you're going to get shot or assaulted by a white guy.
Yeah.
More like, even in the black community, as I worked there prior to 1980, the shootings that we had were all white people shooting police officers in the black community, which I found to be fairly interesting. And the one shooting that I was aware of where a black person shot a police officer, he shot a black sergeant. So it was just a...
Yeah. Well, most crime is, of course, you know, same race.
It's just
crime.
The public perception was diametrically opposed to what was happening in reality.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, I was going over your observations, and one of them I thought was very telling, the need to develop strategies for bringing in external providers.
Yeah.
We had a presentation... sometime recently, I lose track of the days, but on mental health issues.
Yeah.
And we are increasingly seeing people who are mentally ill in our criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to see more as we have cut
funding
for programs to keep these people on their meds. So what kind of programming works for them? I don't think cognitive programming actually...
No, actually, that's where most cognitive programs come from, is the mental health world. There have been some studies of mentally ill offenders. And what they generally find is that the criminogenic behavior is tied to the risk factors that I showed you. That is, when you've got a mentally ill person, you have to stabilize them. You have to deal with the mental illness. But once you've done it, you then have to target their criminogenic risk factors. I think where a lot of mental health programs stop is they get this person on their meds or they get them stabilized, and then they don't target their other risks, who they're hanging around with and their drink, you know, the other factors. I'm not surprised. You know, in the 50s, there were 500,000 people in mental hospitals in this country, and there were less than 100,000 in prison. Today, there's less than 100,000 people in mental hospitals, and there's almost 2 million in prison, so where do you think they went? I mean, you know, it's not surprising that the correctional system has had to deal with a group of people that have no other way. I mean, they end up in the correction system. So they're going to continue to be a burden on you, and you'll just pay for them in a different place is all that will happen.
Right.
You know.
Are you done?
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a question? Are these programs that you're talking to us about today, they're mostly post-prison?
The CBCS were pre-prison.
Pre-prison.
They're pre-prison.
So
we got both in that study. And the research applies to both. Really.
All right. So
applies.
So these programs, cognitive restructuring and behavioral programs in prison,
mm-hmm.
to what extent do we know that they work or do not work?
Well, prison, what has to be done in prison settings is inmates in programs have to be kept separate from general population. If you're going to do programming, effective programming for your inmates, you've got to create units to do programming. When inmate does a few hours and they go back into that general population, all of the norms are antisocial.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that's reinforced is antisocial. Your effect. We see other states will do things like an inmate will go in a program, they'll complete the program, then they'll go in a general population. It's like wasting your money.
Mm-hmm.
The effects all disappear. You've really got to structure. I'm not saying you don't do things with them, work and education and so forth, but you really want to structure your most intensive correctional programming to as that offender moves out of the system, not in the front end, and then keep them for 3 more years. You know, I mean, you know, they're going to behave like the inmates behave.
Right.
So those are strategies internally that the corrections has to kind of wrestle with and develop and so forth.
So where would we find, as policymakers, this body of knowledge or information?
All of this? You can download most of what I presented. Two sources. One, the National Institute of Corrections has compiled all of this information into a manual called Promoting Public Safety Through Effective Interventions.
Okay.
And the other is we have a website at the university where you can get all of our reports, including the Ohio study, and that's www.uc.edu/criminaljustice, one word. NICs is www.nicic.org. And they have, as I said, they've put all this together. They also have some curriculums that they've developed and that they give free of charge to states, along with training and other kind of things. So, and Oregon has been a part of that.
Professor, thank you, Mr. Turing. Could you give some background on that? I know I was at one. I know you've spoken to Multnomah County before. Mm-hmm. Can you let the senators know kind of how? What you've done in the past to look at Oregon's models and where we are with implementing any of this.
Okay. Yeah, I first came to Multnomah half dozen years ago or so ago. NIC, we did a 2.5-day workshop on what works. Following that, I know I was asked to come into Salem, and I assessed two of the jail programs here in Salem. That would probably have been about 3 years ago. I spent a good week of my life in Medford, Oregon, doing a number of workshops there. They had a judge at the time, maybe retired now, who was very interested in trying to develop good programs. Interestingly, Senator, they had done a survey on in their community because he was under the notion that, you know, especially sex offenders, people just wanted these people locked up and so forth. And NIC had spent a lot of money in that community doing some studies and some surveys and so forth. And they did a community survey, and it was a surprising percentage of people that wanted to make sure that they wanted sex offenders locked up, but they wanted them in treatment. They wanted to make sure that they got treatment. So I spent about a week in Medford. I recently came back to... I did a conference in Corvallis last year, and they asked me to come back. I spent a couple days in Eugene doing some work there, talking to their county folks, and then I went back up to Portland and did two days, they're so large they had to split it up. So I did all their probation and correctional staff overview. Oregon, as I said when I started, has always had a reputation of being fairly progressive in correctional programming, certainly at the state level. The counties are, like most states, they kind of are allowed to develop, you know, what they want, and I don't have a good picture across the state, but I think Oregon has been at the forefront in terms of good cognitive programming. Washington State's also done a lot of good work in this area. So these are two states side by side, I think, that are kind of ahead of the curve. There are a number. Colorado is one of the states that's really been doing these things for a long time. Iowa is another state that has been really trying to, I think, at the corrections department level, really implementing good structured programs and good assessment.
All right. Any other questions? Doctor, I appreciate your being here today and good presentation.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions?
Okay. Thank you very much.
11 pages of notes.